start with the lecture. So the one thing that's still kind of looming over all these approaches is the multiple inheritance, which looks like the Swiss Army knife of all modularity and modeling of software. And the big question is whether something like multiple inheritance is still the ultimate principle in reusability, or whether something like mixins is still even better. So what we're going to tackle in order to come up with an answer for that is what the basic problems of composition and decomposition in terms of modules of software actually are, and then have a look at how to solve these problems with the means of these mysterious traits. So we have a look at what traits actually are about, what the semantics of traits. We have a look at how the different basic facilities that come with traits are actually organized and applied to software. And we have a look at how traits are actually implemented in concrete systems. So that's our agenda for today. So let's start with the first assumption that we have had so far, and I would say that inheritance is our means for reusability of already written code. So that was kind of the premise that we have accepted to be true so far. So let's have a look at that once again. In common systems, code sharing is realized, well, at least in the object-oriented world, by doing something like inheritance. And in often, the reusability of code is solved by just inheriting code from a parent in these frameworks. And for that, we have seen different approaches. We have seen approaches which were mainly relying on single inheritance in terms of code inheritance. Then we have looked at multiple inheritance and the cost that multiple inheritance systems the costs that are generated by multiple inheritance systems. We have looked at mixin inheritance and what that means for systems that try to organize their modules in mixins. And all of these approaches were about problems of decomposition and composition. And what that means, I want to show you once again on the next few slides with examples that stem from our particular approaches so far. So the first problem that we wanted to solve was the problem of duplication of code. You remember that situation with the file and socket streams where we somehow wanted to prepend our synchronization code to both of these classes and had to somehow live with either duplicating our code in some way or had to make use of some expensive things like either template variables of some sort or leaving the world of typed systems and go over to something like mixins where you can just plug your classes all together. Or the other way was to do something like multiple inheritance where you could just inherit from both of them, but in the end you would then have to provide certain boilerplate code in both of these versions of our stream implementations, where we would essentially in both streams we would implement our calls to the synchronization methods. And we have essentially duplicated again. However, it's not as large scale as it would have been when we would have incorporated that. Or maybe we could have implemented that with some kind of aggregation, but once again, we would have to duplicate the boilerplate code to actually get to the aggregated object and call there. The other thing that might come to us as a burden is this fine-grained control over the different modules of our software. For example, well, the thing that bothers us the most in that case is that for actual control over which of the parts of our object hierarchy is shared, the only means of actually determining whether we want to share or whether we want to separate object representation for us is on a class level. So, for example, in this diagram here, we would have an object design where there's two planes. One is a camera plane and a combat plane. Both are planes that would like to be mounted by some kind of special equipment. The camera plane would like to have a spy camera, and the combat plane would like to have some way of killing people, so it needs a precision gun. And so if we then try to integrate that into a common thing, like the police drone, which likes to spy on people and shoot them, well, probably not at the same time, but yeah, you have the mountable plane, and you can now either decide to keep the representation for this mountable plane apart, or whether you want to share it. For example, it doesn't make sense to really keep the fuel separated for such a thing. Well, it's just one plane. Why should I keep two fuel tanks for that? However, if I join my representation of both of them, I will also have to join my equipment slot. And, well, being not able to disambiguate between the gun and the spy cam, that's probably not a good idea. So in these cases, you would probably like to separate them from each other. But in our systems, we only have the control on the class level. So I can only decide for the whole mountable plane thing whether I want to disambiguate or not. Well, of course, that's an absurd example here, but you get the crucial point. I can only determine on the class level and not on the on more fine-grained level what I want to share or what I want to keep disambiguated. So that's one of the things. The other thing is that when I have complicated class relations and inheritance, if I do something like linearization in order to keep my hierarchy in a way that I can definitely say which of the method offerings that I have in my class hierarchy is the one that it's going to be selected when I issue a call, then for these systems, when I apply linearization, once again, I can only... my linearization is something which is on a global level. So this will be for all the spots where I actually have some kind of common parent, the common parent will be taken away and put in one specific slot in my linearization list. And that's where it will be found. So I don't have explicit control. I cannot really disambiguate between the different contexts in which I derive my object from a certain parent, whether I want to have it earlier or later in my linearization. And, well, of course, there's the different pros and cons that you get from having your reference to your parent with a super reference or with explicit qualified specification. So we've had that when we talked about the C++ thing a little bit more. So yeah, the fine-grained specification of duplication or sharing and which of the methods I want to to actually dispatch to is something which is only on a very coarse level. So I cannot really determine very precisely what I want to actually happen in my system. So that's for the lack of fine-grained control. Then there's also designs, of course, that my, that turns out to be a quite questionable design when I put my code that I actually would like to find somewhere in a position in the middle. For example, I would, in principle, I would have preferred my synchronization code to be here to be able to have a socket stream that does not synchronize at all for performance reasons. However, due to the to limited systems where I cannot actually produce something like mixins or multiple inheritance, these systems might lead us to misuse this inheritance scheme to put the common code somewhere in a place where both of the of the of the streams have actually access, and that would be somewhere up the hierarchy. So that would be one of the misuses of inheritance, to put common code somewhere in the parent, although I might not really use it in all the cases. And yeah, this might lead to quite dubious designs. For example, there it turns out that there is also a concept of methods becoming obsolete in children. So you might specialize an object. For example, the stack is a specialized form of the linked list. However, the former completely valid method add of an object at a specific position in my linked list now at the stack is not helpful anymore. But one might even destroy the complete semantics that I have. I might want to disallow that operation specifically. And well, from the point of view of the type system, I don't have any way of discouraging the use of that. I have to do that with throwing runtime exceptions or marking my object as deprecated or something, but it never disappears anymore if it has been out there in the wild. And that doesn't keep people from just calling it and maybe destroy my complete semantics. And, well, that's because we have this Liskov substitution principle that says that we need to still provide everything that the parent has provided so far. That's the kind of basic principle in polymorphic code. However, whether that really makes sense in specialized versions, well, that, you see, it's not such a such a clear decision as it has seemed in the beginning when polymorphic code was introduced. So some people even go as far as saying whether implementation inheritance is even something that's not desirable in code and is even considered to be an anti-pattern. Well, fractions if you look at a large APIs, you might find, for example, in the Java 8 API that there's even passages in the documentation that clearly tell you that you might destroy the complete inner workings of what they provide by calling simple methods that are offered in your by the API, just because they realized that by inheriting code from someone. So yeah, of course you might argue for, well, that's a clear misuse of inheritance, but that is the kind of the way that that in object-oriented systems code reusage is in general realized, or that many people tend to do it like that. So from the point of view of someone who designs a language, another principle is quite common that says that everything that is not explicitly prohibited will eventually be used or done in some way. So it might be completely nonsense, and it might look like nobody would ever use it in that way. Just think of large companies like Facebook, Google, or Microsoft, which have large code bases. Eventually, you will find some employee does not read the documentation as he or she is supposed to, and then actually misuses it in some way. As long as it's possible, at some point there will be someone who actually misuses it. So it's in general not a good idea to make it possible for people to misuse your things. Yes, please. This is, of course, an idea that comes to mind quite quickly. However, that's exactly the point where this Liskov substitution principle keeps you from allowing something like changing your public modifier to the private modifier, because whenever you use your subclass from a variable of the parent type, for example, you still need to provide these methods. So, for example,
is an abstract rule you use to keep things clean, but if you're defining a new object which has a different purpose than its parent object, and it's just using that parent to achieve some goal,
because you're by the Liskov principle, you're allowed to do something like the linked list. LL is a new stack, for example. That's the basics of polymorphism. That's what the Liskov principle says that you should be allowed to do. And from there, the languages completely ignore the history of the data flow from which the actual reference comes from, and still, the only thing that's checked is the type of the variable, which is in this case the linked list, and this offers something like the add of some number and some object. And although you might have hidden it somewhere in there, well, by using it as its super type, you will once again make it visible. Of polymorphic types, yeah. So, and actually, it's something that the compiler does not allow to do. So, that's why. So, you cannot really change your modifier back to private if it has been public at once. I don't even know whether you can make it public if it has been private at some point. But I think you cannot even access the private ones. From the child, so that probably doesn't even make sense. So, yeah. Okay. So all the problems that we have heard so far have some all this duplication and fragility and lack of control are somehow related to the question of how to. Well, we have some modules of functionality. That we don't want to duplicate, that we don't want to be redundant in some way. We want to find the optimal distribution of my functionality on my model of the reality that I design within my types. So these are all questions of. Distributing functionality over some kind, in our case, a hierarchy, as we are in these object-oriented systems. And that's exactly where this approach of traits is kicking in. It says that a lot of the problems originate from the very tight coupling of modeling and implementation. Well, the problems originate from exactly this tight coupling, and it seems like that for modeling interfaces that are hierarchical seem to be a quite good idea. However, functionality seems to be somewhat not hierarchical, but kind of separate models that want to be combined in a more kind of democratic way. So you would not prefer any of the partners, but you wouldn't want to decide on the same level which of the parts of your components you actually want to, or which components you actually want to use in order to provide the functionality that you have modeled within your hierarchies. So the central idea in traits would be to actually separate the different processes that are going on when programming, in the sense of, that we have the modeling of hierarchies, we have object creation, which gives some kind of representation to an object, and we have the assembling of the functionality. So we somehow want to compose from a set of functions that we have provided somewhere our combination of functions that actually make up or that actually fulfill the constraints that I have put on my object with the modeling hierarchy and link it somehow to my object representation. So what are the means of doing that? So for the modeling phase of our hierarchical signatures, what we want to use is actually we want to use something like interfaces, which is something that has no implementations attached to. It's just pure signatures of functions and, well, maybe several of them in a package. So that's interfaces, and those are used for modeling our hierarchies of systems. And the containers for actual code should then be something different, which is these so-called traits, which acts as containers for code, and are used as modules which can be assembled in order to provide the functionality that we are going to then link to a certain interface in order to create our final class then. So class is then the concept of, it is the entity that links the interface to the functionality from the traits, and also comes with a memory representation, which I can then use to decide whether I want to share or whether I want to disambiguate between certain needs. So that's what the purpose of the class is actually. And yeah, what does it mean in terms of expressivity? You might remember from last time our very abstract model of object-oriented systems, where we would have maps from some kind of names or identifiers to method bodies, and we had these special symbols for something being undefined or being in conflict. And yeah, so that still is the same model as we have had for mixins. If you think back to mixins, we have had as the primary composition operator, we had the asymmetric join, which would always prefer the subclass to the superclass in some way. In this case, we for the traits, we have something different, if we used the so-called trait speak, we have the trait sum, But that's just another name for the thing that we have learned before, which is the symmetric join. So in order to compose our traits, we now leave some kind of preferred partner and go over to the symmetric join, which means that if either of the partner has left one of the keys in an undefined state, then the value of the other partner will be chosen. So same is for the other partner, it's just the other way around. And in case that both of the partners actually specify the same code for a certain key, we will then just take especially this value, which is a certain body, and this will actually be the valid entry for our specific key. Or in case both of these traits disagree on the method body that that needs to be dispatched to, in these cases we will just take the top or conflict symbol as the actual value. So far that might be the way of realizing composition as would be intuitive. However, it might not be practical from the start, because as soon as you have same entries pointing to different implementations, you will end up with a lot of conflicting things. So the question is now how we can actually deal with these kinds of conflicts, and that's where a few other expressions on traits actually appear on the screen, which is these two expressions of exclusion and aliasing. So, or aliasing, I think. So for exclusion, we provide an expression with a minus, and the small a that you see here is a certain key, and not a mapping as the trait T is here. So I can subtract a key from a trait, and that means, for all other keys that are not exactly our key A, this just means that we keep our trait as it is, and if it happens that the key that is looked up is exactly U, then we won't define the trait for that. So this takes away certain entries in our mapping. And aliasing is kind of copying entries in our trait. So what we do there is, see that here we have once again two keys, what we see here is that we copy the value that is in fact the entry for B, and use it each case that the A is queried for. So what does that mean? In case that my N is actually the key that is in front of the arrow, then I will redirect to the entry that is stored for B, and in every other case I just return the old values. So in this case the entry for A is overwritten with the entry of B. So that's just a kind of definition in that case. So these are the building blocks for expressions on traits, and with that we can assemble the functionality of the whole thing. If I'm done with composing the traits one to each other, then I can go over to link the traits to some kind of object representation, and that's just plain asymmetric join in our case, because we want to have the opportunity within the actual class C in the end. You want to have the opportunity to still determine a few things like linking to certain memory areas. Something that I have not yet mentioned is that in a trait, I call a mapping only a trait if the entries don't map to attribute offsets. So traits are always thought of as being attribute-less. The only thing that they have is methods. So the only way to somehow access our object representation is to introduce function names or keys that map to yet undefined methods, which then need to be implemented in the end in the object whereby traits will be linked to, and these entries then are overwritten with the versions that you find in the class, and within those methods, then I have access to the attributes. Yes, please.
So traits are basically mixed things with aliasing and without properties or keys.
And without any linearization involved. So they are all on the same level. Yeah, but I don't remember exactly. Some guy last time was somehow Scala. Was it you? Yeah. So Scala mixes these terms a little bit. So it turns out that the things that are called traits in Scala, they can have properties. That's more the Mixian style. And also, if you use them with a with keyword, you mix them into the hierarchy, although they are called trait. And they always claim that, they are always on the same level, but as soon as you apply them to each other, they get linearized. So it's not exactly what the original trait concept was. However, you still use the name trait. And they say it's all on the same level as long as there's no intersections, but well, the intersections in the keys are the whole point in that. So, yeah. You see, so that's why I don't think that the Scala implementation is the best example for mix-ins or traits, because they just mix the terms up. But in fact, what they have is mix-ins. And they even call it mix-in composition or something when you use these with things. So yeah, but yeah, of course. At first, it looks quite similar. That's why we do this quite formal way of specifying what the expressivity actually is, in order to make it possible for you to disambiguate between these two kind of fundamental differences of these two approaches, and. Who knows how traits might be in future related with? Well, maybe the traits will be related with the ones that are introduced in the Scala world, and the old approach might be forgotten at some place. But I would say I would use the terms for the approaches which were there first, and that's how I disambiguate these. That's how you learn it here. So I've checked the history of publications and papers, and in the beginning it was like mix-ins that and traits that. Okay, but of course concrete implementations might arrive on that and might do something completely different. You never have the control over the actual keywords that they use for these things. Okay, so. Let's stop the rant and go over to what you can actually do with these things. So with these concepts now, we can try to tackle the things that we have had before. The traits offer a few kind of unique properties. For example, what you have is a kind of a flat ordering. There's no linearization or something else. You always have the same precedence of both partners of composition. trait sum is always treating both of them exactly the same. And you have to explicitly disambiguate between the specific or particular members by using aliasing or exclusion of certain keys. There's precedence in the end. As soon as you start using the asymmetric join, that's where the trait world connects to the usual class inheritance world. And in an ideal only traits-based system, you would only have the chance to perform that once and for all in order to fix the linking of certain methods to certain memory areas in order to get the getters and setters right, or to get them in a way that you would actually like them. However, in practical systems that have grown from time to time, you will see that asymmetric joins will be used for just the standard class compositions, and you get the chance to integrate something like traits at some level. So there's in these systems, there's several levels where you can use the asymmetric join with just extends clauses or something. In the end, when the whole system is then run, all that you will experience is that you cannot disambiguate anymore between the functions or the entries that came from trait A or trait B, or even the ones that came from the binding in the end to the final object. They are all flattened and treated as equals. So that's what the flattening gives you. And yeah, the only conflicts that arise is when you have these maps pointing to different implementations of certain keys, and yeah, that's the ones that you have to resolve. And for that, you get aliasing and exclusion. And in the end, you can sort out conflicts when you connect everything to an object. Okay. So, yeah. Well, you have already asked about the disambiguation between mixins and traits. So we have already talked about that. We have traits, mixins, and class inheritance. And well, it's just different types of expressions that are used to compose your class hierarchies. You have the approach of defining curried second-order type operators and have something like linearization. Well, if you have something like that, you're going to point to mixins. So that's what the second-order type operators are about. Then you have the fine-grained, flat-ordered composition of modules. Well, that's composition of modules, flat ordering. Well, that should ring a bell for traits. And the last thing is, well, if you define just a local partial order on types and have precedence of types with a certain ordering, well, in this case, you will have something like class inheritance. So that's partial order together with a method resolution order. And of course, you might have systems where you can combine the different approaches in order to get you the maximum flexibility in your designs. Yeah. That's the ones that we have talked about. So in parallel, instead of sequentially, composition is unordered, so there's no linearization effects. And if you have something like attributes in your hierarchies, you might run into things like state conflicts. Remember this disambiguation and sharing. This is done by concentrating that in a single object and having all the glue code, to link it everything together. Well, that's just kept in one place, and if you've done it once, you can just forget about that. And you always find where to patch it in case you did it somehow wrong. Okay, facing our composition and decomposition problems. Well, the duplicated features is something, well, you can just factor the actual implementations out into certain unique traits, so you don't need to duplicate code in any way. As soon as you realize that it's duplicate, you can just move it to one module and then share it afterwards. Inappropriate hierarchies, well, traits are kind of kept separate from the actual hierarchy, so you specify the hierarchies without any actual references to the implementations, so there's also no reason why you should actually do something like an inappropriate hierarchy anymore. You can just, in the end, link everything the way you like it, and the specification can be done separate from that, so there's no reason, because it's just no link between the modeling entities and the modules of functionality, at least during the modeling phase. For composition problems, well, conflicting features, the only things that can actually really conflict are, well, for once there's methods, for the other part that's the attributes. The attributes are only linked in the very end, so and they have to be made explicit by leaving abstract methods in your implementations, and well, for each of your needs of attributes, you can just leave the implementation of your connection to the state somehow open until the very end, where you then link everything together in your object, and only then determine whether you want to share or whether you want to disambiguate. So that's for the states. For the methods, well, you will have conflicts in the method names, but with means of exclusion and aliasing, you can just make your way around the conflicts and specify everything the way you want it to work. Lack of control, well, we have said already that you can determine in the very end how you want do your you want to treat the certain entries of your map in by means of, well, you compose them in an equal way, so to say, on the same level, so there's just no that's just a question of control in that case, because you have everything on the same level in any way, and as soon as anything is debatable, you can just introduce an alias for that. So you have the control with these specialized operations on the types. Well, the dispersal of glue code throughout your complete type hierarchy, well, that also goes away if you have one centralized object creation facility and you can put the glue code in there. And for fragile hierarchies, well, the implementation details are not really connected anymore to the hierarchy, so, well, that's not an issue anymore in our case. So, first question might be, now that we have heard so much nice promises, so many nice promises from the traits approach, can we somehow augment classical languages with these new shiny features? And, well, has anyone an idea? Well, for Scala, we have seen there is the keyword of traits. Is there any other language that comes to your mind? Yes. I think they might have something like that already. So you would say an idea would be to augment interfaces with code.
The interfaces will come out
here. And that's quite the approach that a lot of languages are actually doing right now. So thank you for that. I didn't explicitly think about Kotlin, but well, we're going to see how that relates a little bit. So we have, for example, C# here, which does not explicitly feature something like traits, but instead you have something called extension methods. I don't know who of you is familiar with C#. 1, 2, 3. Well, considerable amount, I would say. Have you heard about the extension methods? Yes? Somewhat? Yes? Well, everyone? Well, that's impressive, I would say. It's quite a rather new feature, isn't it? Well, sorry?
I saw it by name, not by user.
Okay. So the idea is to uncouple method definitions from certain bodies. And what you can do is you can retrospectively add methods to types without editing the type itself. So what it especially can do is what you have already indicated, you can provide further other definitions to interface methods that... Well,
what's it say? Definitions of interface methods.
Okay, so that's what. Okay, so you can define methods which are then treated as belonging to that specific interface. So yeah, and if you keep in mind that with interfaces you can have, you can just implement several of these interfaces. Well, that's a feature that some people would say can be treated as kind of the poor man's multiple inheritance. Well, you can have just several parents and all of them can bring certain methods with them. So, yeah, you get something like multiple inheritance with that. So what you have to do in order to get to that is you have to declare some kind of static class with the definition of some static methods. So, well that can be done. Then we explicitly declare the first parameter as the new receiver type of that method. So that's how we connect this static method to a certain type, especially to a certain interface in that case. And for that, we can use a certain modifier keyword, which is, which is conveniently called this. So we have some kind of access to our receiver over this parameter. Then we have to somehow import the carrier of that static method, which in future should be act as the extension method, at least if it's not already in the same scope. And then we can start calling this extension in the infix form, which means that we can call it with the receiver not being in the parameters list, but once again with emphasis on the receiver, so it goes to the front of the calling expression. If I say import the carrier class to the into the scope, I should probably also say that what we need to do is not bring it into the scope of the original interface that we were want to extend, but we have to bring it into the scope of the place where I want to call the extension method. That's a subtle difference there. So probably let us probably do an example of that. That will make life a little bit easier for us. So you might remember the example from the mixins thing, where we had the persons and the doors which we want to pass in our adventure game, and we have very short doors and we have locked doors in there, or at least potentially, and we somehow want to combine these different aspects so that we get convenient means of creating these entities. So with our newly acquired extension methods, what we can do now is we start off from, the person is just something that we have already had before, so that's nothing new. Instead, what we see is that we have interfaces short and locked, which we want to use later on in order to import these new methods into our short lock door. So we implement locked and short from our final product, the short lock door. And the way to integrate these extension methods into our short lock door is now to provide a static class, which has just nothing to do with the original short or locked. I don't know what you have to smoke to come up with something like that, but well, it's the way it is, like that. And here we have to then provide a static method can open, and the way that it is connected now is via this first parameter, which is augmented by this special this keyword, which kind of tags the first parameter as being the new receiver. And yeah, if you do it like this, then this will be treated as the well, as belonging to the locked interface as member function. And yeah, let's see how we can use it. So the short locked door is created as a new short locked door, and now what I can do is I can explicitly call this can open on the door, although the door itself, well, I think I haven't even mentioned any door. It doesn't have a can open member method. Also, neither the short nor the locked have such a method, but if I search through my scope, I somehow find a class that, even a static class with a static method that actually has a specification of this and locked. So locked is something that I implement, and that's how the whole connection goes. Yes, please? Sorry, what? I didn't get the first part.
Yeah, I'm sure that we can extend exactly interfaces, but not classes.
You can also. You can also extend classes, can't you?
Yeah, you can this way extend classes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Interfaces cannot include implementation.
But that's how you get implementations into interfaces. Of course, it's not perfect. It's just, well, that's how these extension methods actually they have these downsides. So that's also what you see next. You can have unexpected errors with doing it that way. But just one point why I do this extension on the interfaces here is just to show that you can somehow then compose from the interfaces. And you can have several parents that way, so that's something that's not clearly seen, that this can be achieved with a otherwise single inheritance language. So yeah, that's what I was aiming for by inter. But of course, you can also extend other classes. So that's it's possible. It's just the example here. Okay. So however. If you use these extension methods, they somehow provide aspects of traits to you. You can transparently extend arbitrary types from somewhere external. You can attach functionality to an object that might originate from a completely different tree of inheritance. So you can somehow bring code into your class from a side branch, which is something that is clearly new for this thing. And if you have been looking for something pretty similar to model inheritance, this is kind of a quick relief for you. You can just try to start using that. However, that's still not the same thing as traits. You'll be still left with if you do it in exactly this quite absurd way that I've done it, you will be ending up with a lot of empty interfaces that just fly around there. And also, this the thing is that in the end, the trait approach would promise us that the methods that come from the extension methods and the ordinary methods should be treated in a kind of an equal way. So you would not be able to disambiguate between them anymore afterwards when you use the final product. But from at least from the trait theory. However, that's not what's happening in the extension method approach in practice. Well, you'll see that here. So once again, I have provided the can open through the extension method. And let's say that I have actually foreseen that I will somehow try to have a method like can open, and I have already equipped my interface with a kind of a placeholder for that, an abstract signature, just stating that I will have can open. With extension methods, you cannot overwrite these things. So in this case, when I mix my or when I extend my interface with the extension method can open here, this will lead to just failure because the interfaces method will still have the priority over the extension method. So there's no kind of same level composition in any way. Instead, it's just a one-way preference that you get with that. So, although you haven't really provided an implementation of that method, this still overrides the extension method. So, this limits a little bit the use for these things. You cannot really implement things that have been left open with just extension methods. Well, not that way at least. So that's why it's just static extension methods. There's also a thing called virtual extension methods, which is a quite similar approach than the ordinary extension methods. It's something that you get from Java 8, and it goes one step further. It attaches implementation to interface methods, well, at least in a very, that's what you, that's what we can say for that. And the actual thing is that for that, what they did is they patched the actual function method resolution algorithm in the virtual machine to integrate a phase where they look for implementations of a method within the interfaces. So they actually that's a little bit more than just syntactic sugar that they introduce here. And with the virtual extension methods, you get that you actually get entries in the kind of the virtual table or in this method resolution for the methods that you provide that way. With that, we can overwrite formerly abstract versions of our methods. So the can open from locked is able to override the abstract announcement of can open if it is done in the way like in this way. So if I have a short locked door here as interfaces that I implement, then the in the final product in the short locked door here, I will have an actual implementation of this can open thing, and the short locked door will still be a door. So that is somehow, if you use it just that way, you get something which is pretty similar to this traits approach. You have a kind of a composition on the same level on the particular partners. So door, locked, and short are merged in the way that we have seen with this with this symmetric join. So these would these would map both to not defined yet. These would map to an actual implementation. This is just another implementation, and they would cancel out the undefined entry in there. However, as this integrates into a whole system that's already has some history, you can have hierarchies on the interfaces at some point, and that's where the actual equal treatment of the interfaces, well, or the equal treatments that we would be used from traits actually breaks, because as soon as you make one interface extend the other, you will give one interface priority over the others, and this might once again destroy this same level composition that you have in the trait theory. However, you will we will have quite a lot of the aspects of traits in this approach. You will also be able to come up with this in conflict thing as soon as you try to combine two interfaces. For example, if this one would be called can open, this would lead to a conflict in there, which would then have to be resolved in the entity that combines them to each other. So here we would have to perform, well, we would have to actually just provide another implementation of can open, which would then resolve the conflict by either providing something itself or redirecting to each of these implementations. So, however, what you have to keep in mind is still that if you try to implement one of these one of these interfaces that carries a virtual extension method, and if your object itself extends, well, you can have extension and implementation at the same time. So if you have extends on another, for example, the abstract door, and if the abstract door also has, well, if I have my abstract door has an abstract class, and if this one also has an abstract Boolean can open, for example, then the undefined entry in the abstract door overrides the actually provided implementation of that method that comes from the virtual extension method, and yeah, that way your virtual methods can never override entries that you get through your ordinary class inheritance. So it's still not a flattened approach in that case. So yeah, that's what you get when you mix extension methods or virtual extension methods with ordinary inheritance. So yeah, but you have to live with that. That's just an evolving language. So we've seen several attempts to integrate things like traits into well, grown languages. So with that, we can the original idea of modeling hierarchies with interfaces and composite with traits is somehow kind of there. However, you can still destroy everything by reverting back to old mechanisms like ordinary extension. So the question would be whether I can in some way design language that only relies on traits and has the full support for traits. in order to create something like a simplified multiple inheritance without all the effects that that make us make the implementation so difficult and even make us pay and runtime overhead. And well, the question is there even a language that offers the complete subset of trade things? But you have a question to be. So you're talking about this implementation here? Well, it happens that interface methods are always default public, and you cannot specify anything else there. So the access modifiers are not really an option here. So that's also one of the things that is not provided with these virtual extension methods, neither with the ordinary extension methods. You don't get something like hiding, once again. You cannot do the exclusion thing and the alias thing. Well, you can do that by just coding your method appropriately, but there's not an explicit support for that in the language. So you don't get the full, fully blown trait approach here. So what kind of?
You're doing this with a class which has a private data number, just any integer. Then in an extension, you could say, well, I'm extending that class. You just mentioned this, and suddenly you get the ability to change the private data number of the class.
Well, that's the thing here with the at least with the approach that they did in the Java virtual methods, you cannot do the same thing. You've told that the ordinary extension methods from the C# world can extend the classes. Didn't it? Well, that's something that you can't do here. So you can't really extend something else than something other than interfaces. And from point of view of scope, you don't have a reference to the class that you're going to attach this interface later on, or at least not directly from the interface. So you don't really have an access to those fields and private elements and anything. And if you would actually want to modify the state, you would have to abstractly specify getters and setters in your interface, which would then have to be bound somehow to implementations at this point here. That is an interesting question. I think I have not really tried to do that, but at least you get the receiver as first parameter. So everything that is valid, at least what is in the scope when you use, in this case, the receiver type, that is something that you might touch. But I think with that, you cannot really access anything that's private or something. Is it? You don't know whether you've tried it? Okay, so I think you can somehow access a few of the methods, but probably only the public ones from here. Good. So both of these things are not exactly the same as traits because, well, they only have partial implementations of that thing. So let's have a look at a language that actually has full support for something like that. And, well, I was searching a lot, and there's a lot of languages which have this kind of partial implementations of these trait systems, but in the end I had to revert back to the original publication where I actually found the fully blown definition of what traits actually are supposed to be, and they provided a default implementation and they chose Squeak which made me, well, waste almost 1 week of doing experiments with a, well, it's personal experience, so don't take it for a fact, but I really dislike compilers and language systems that come with a virtual machine image and force their kind of graphical user interface on you in order to program. So that's what you get when you install something like Squeak. You get an interpreter for a whole virtual machine image that pops up a graphical user interface with a quite 70s style of clicking and modifying things. And maybe there's people out there who really like to do their programming like that, but I would have preferred to have a command line interface to a compiler and be glad with that. But yeah, that's sadly not how the world rolls. So yeah, that's what I have to endure for creating that kind of things. Anyway, Squeak as kind of it's a small talk dialect, and it has an implementation for traits. And Squeak is something that's Smalltalk is something which has a little bit of an, at least for our eyes now, very unusual syntax, but is the source of many of the basic object-oriented concepts. So a lot of them originate back to the times of Smalltalk. Even just our common asymmetric join is something that appeared first in the Smalltalk world. And that's where you also find an implementation of traits. And it's just for the sake of completeness that I have put a whole code example on here. I don't expect you to really understand the full extent of everything here. The only thing that I want to highlight is actually the place where you can see that they have implemented the traits approach, and that's that position here where you can see this specific expression. This is exactly this aliasing implementation. Here is here is an example for how you can actually implement this kind of or where you can actually see how these expressions are somehow used in type constructors here. And yeah, apart from that, there's a lot of Smalltalk or Squeak code here that might confuse you, so don't look too much into the details. That's really something else. You have to really take your time to really parse that. Anyway, if you have the time to do so in the interest, then feel free to look on in that slide, Tom. So in principle, what they have there is that it's fully implemented, and that's one of the major sources for other program languages to copy features from. So a lot of the things, approaches that you have seen realized in Smalltalk or Squeak have made it to mainstream languages. You see these all these extension methods, virtual extension methods, all of these seem to be inspired by these principles. However, the way that they are implemented, you have to really like this type of graphical programming, and I don't want to force you to do so. So I'm going to go on with just summing up all the lessons you should have learned right now. So with single inheritance, multiple inheritance, and mix-ins, you have only seen a fragment of what's actually possible. There's still this concept of traits, where you have more fine-grained control over the composition, and also decouples the modeling phase from the composition of functionality. There's languages that actually implement that, and the implementations in most cases only partially they're only partially compatible with the theoretical concept, but as they are still quite valuable to the programmer, I would say. So if you're more interested in that, have a look at these papers, and I think there's also books there, yeah. And yeah, that's where I got all my stuff from. So with that, I would say today it's a little bit earlier than last time, so I don't think that we met with that. Apart from that, let's finish that.